This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With new heat records set all over the world, is there a threshold, a resting place where this planet goes? How hot can it get? You will hear new science from Dr. Will Steffen in Australia. Then meteorologist and storm chaser Bob Henson covers the heat and the storms of summer 2018. I'm Alex Smith with eco-shocking news coming your way. Planet Earth is hurtling towards a new, hotter state. But how hot? Are there landing spots that are safe enough for a human civilization? We get a big step towards answers with new science published by the National Academy on August 6th. The title is Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. The paper is from a distinguished team of scientists led by Dr. Will Steffen. Will was educated in the American South and transplanted to Australia, where he led research institutes and advised governments. Currently, Dr. Steffen is an emeritus professor at the Australian National University and a counselor with the Climate Council of Australia. He's also a senior fellow at the Stockholm Resilience Centre. Will Steffen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
I have to tell you, it's been a horrible summer in the Northern Hemisphere. The global fire map is like something I've never seen. I was wiped out by smoke, and other regions were whipped with strings of wet and windy storms. Will, do you think we have already embarked on serious climate change?
Yeah, I certainly have, and you could mirror that down here in the Southern Hemisphere. When you look across Australia, we've had a couple of mass bleaching events on the Great Barrier Reef, killing a high percentage. I think up to 30% of that reef is gone. We've seen fires, too. In fact, our fire season is extending at both ends, and it's now occupying 11 months out of the 12 months of the year. We've got serious drought now in New South Wales and Queensland. So, yeah, I think climate disruption is happening at an alarming rate pretty much right around the planet.
Now, to begin, for the layperson, is there a difference between a tipping point, as popularized by Al Gore, well, 12 years ago, and the thresholds that you look for in this paper?
No, they're pretty much the same thing. We use the term tipping element, which is actually the physical system which could, within it, have a tipping point or threshold. So those two terms are used pretty much synonymously. In our paper, what we're trying to say is that in addition to individual parts of the Earth having tipping points, example being the Arctic sea ice or perhaps the Amazon rainforest, we're talking about a number of these things acting together.
Well, I'd like to go through the four main questions you worked with in order, and they're understandable to all of us and go far beyond just scientific curiosity. These are things we need to know and that governments need to know. So question one, quote, is there a planetary threshold in the trajectory of the Earth system that, if crossed, could prevent stabilization in a range of intermediate temperature rises? That's a pretty scary question, isn't it? Could you explain it a bit?
Yeah, look, I think the dominant framework for the climate change issue is that our emissions of greenhouse gases will be the dominant driver no matter how hot it gets. In other words, the more we emit, the hotter it gets. Once we stop emitting, the Earth is going to stay there. In other words, we could park it at 2 or 3 degrees and it'll stay there. We're saying that the Earth is not a simple system. It's a complex system. And a lot of complex systems have behavior which looks at sharp transitions between a couple of well-defined states. So our argument is that there are a number of individual tipping elements that have their own thresholds in the Earth system, plus some other feedbacks which may not have thresholds but still accelerate climate change. These can act together like a stack of dominoes. When you start pushing one domino, it knocks another off and another off, and together that line of dominoes falling constitutes a planetary threshold. So we are hypothesizing with a fair bit of evidence that there exists a planetary threshold somewhere probably between 1.5 and 2 degrees and 4 degrees, that if we go across that, the Earth system, it's going to move to a much hotter state out of our control. So that's basically what that first question is designed to address. And in our paper, we say, yes, there is likely to be a planetary threshold.
And you've already talked really about the second question, which is, if there is a threshold, where is it, or maybe when is it? And you've touched on that. So question three, Quote, if a threshold is crossed, what are the implications, especially for the well-being of human societies? Okay, well, there are whole books written about possible impacts of a hotter world, but can you give us some clues?
Yeah, well, one of the things you'd obviously see is an enormous increase in extreme weather events. And we're already seeing some of this, but this would be extreme weather on steroids. It'd be fires, droughts, extreme heat, big changes in rainfall, extreme rainfall events, worse tropical cyclones or hurricanes in the northern hemisphere, and so on. That's an obvious one. But I think another one that's sort of a sleeper there that people don't think about so much is that we have designed and built our civilizations around reasonably stable patterns of temperature and rainfall. For example, big agricultural zones, central USA is a good example, Western Europe is a good example, Indo-Gangetic Plain, Northeast China. These together feed billions of people. And if we cross the threshold and rapidly go toward a hothouse Earth state, all of those systems are going to be disrupted. And it's hard to predict exactly how they're going to be disrupted. So what this means is just something as simple and basic as providing food for the human population is going to become a massive and difficult task. So that's a good example of what's coming our way. Another one is that sea level is going to rise and continue to rise for centuries and centuries as we go on to a hothouse Earth trajectory. We're estimating somewhere between 20 and 40 meters of sea level rise could eventuate way down the track. It takes a long time for the ice to melt. But you could get sea level rise rates as high as 2 meters a century. And that's a pretty high rate. That now comes into a human perspective in terms of a very large amount of coastal infrastructure that then becomes vulnerable. And you can go on and on. It's not a very pretty picture when you actually start looking at it in detail.
Well, I'd like to leave until later the question about what human actions could save us from the worst of a hothouse world. It's important, but there's a couple things I'd like to get to first, including in the AR5, or the fifth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That was finalized in 2014, and it talked about a medium confidence that a threshold for abrupt and irreversible climate change exists. Does your paper go beyond medium confidence that that threshold is there?
Yeah, I think we've got much higher confidence than that, because as we say, all of these processes that would form a planetary threshold, we've seen how they've operated in the past, so they're real processes. Also, we have a fair bit of evidence that some of them, even at a 1 degree temperature rise, are being destabilized. Arctic sea ice is a good example of that. Amazon forest is another example of that, and so on. And we see weakening of longer-term ocean and terrestrial carbon sinks. So this isn't fanciful stuff. These things are already starting to happen. So I think we could reinforce what the IPCC said and say that with new knowledge, we could upgrade that probability to higher than medium. Now we've really got to do some work to try to pin down a little bit more precisely where that threshold might lie in terms of temperature rise.
But does this threshold idea compare with the planetary boundaries advanced by your co-author Johan Rockström and his team in Sweden?
Very much so, because what we're saying is, and the planetary boundaries are a reasonably conservative approach, saying that if we want to be really certain or with a very high degree of probability that we're going to maintain a Holocene-like state of the Earth system, then we have to make sure we avoid these thresholds and these feedback processes. So we've set boundaries for 9 processes. One of them is obviously CO2 in the atmosphere, but there are others like the amount of important biomes, forests you can lose, and things like that. So the planetary boundaries approach is actually saying if you want to be really sure that you're going to avoid the sort of hothouse Earth trajectory we're painting in this paper, then you stay within the boundaries.
Is the hothouse Earth pathway different from runaway climate change, as Dr. James Hansen once suggested was possible?
It depends on what you mean by runaway. We never use the term because it's something that we don't talk about in complex systems theory or analysis. What we're saying is that there are other states of the Earth system which are actually stable. They don't run away, but they are much hotter than the one that we've developed our civilizations in. And what we're saying is that one of those states, the hothouse Earth one, could be accessible if we cross these thresholds. So we're hypothesizing that if you cross that threshold, you get a period of very rapid climate change. But this isn't runaway. It's going to restabilize at a hotter state with much less ice at the poles, much higher sea levels, different rainfall patterns, and so on. And we've seen a state like that in the recent past. The so-called mid-Miocene, about 15 or 16 million years ago, was just like that state, and the continents were about in the same configuration. So this sort of thing is plausible. So no, we don't use the term runaway. It's going to keep going on forever. But the Earth could shift to a much hotter, much less hospitable, stable state.
It worries me a bit that this paper calls for stewardship of the entire Earth system, including the biosphere. Frankly, we've utterly failed at stewardship. The idea of humans running the biosphere is a bit frightening to me. Maybe we need to greatly decrease our numbers and impacts to allow the biosphere to self-regulate. What do you say?
Well, that's a good point, and stewardship isn't management. They're two very different terms. In fact, stewardship, in my view of the word and its proper meaning, is that we really manage ourselves to become good stewards, which is exactly what you say, allow natural processes to reestablish. In other words, we need to protect major biomes like the Amazon rainforest. We don't manage it. We just take our pressure off of it. So I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think if you read the supplementary info, we had some limited space in the main text. We go into more detail about what stewardship actually entails. But we were very careful not to use the word management, but to use the word stewardship.
The mainstream chatter is usually about technological fixes needed to keep this civilization, we hope, going more or less the way it is. But your paper goes beyond that, calling for, quote, behavioral changes, new governance arrangements, and transformed social values. Maybe that's more important than a technical fix. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. And that's a point I think we made very clearly, so I'm glad you picked up on that. Technological fixes is more of the same, and the more you look at them, the more they're taking the old cause-effect linear logic without considering that those actions are embedded in a complex system that may surprise you with how they react. So a transformed value system is, as you said earlier, we become stewards of the system, which means we actually manage ourselves to take pressure off of the Earth system and allow many of the natural processes and feedbacks to operate. They've kept the place stable for about 12,000 years and allowed us to develop. And now we're really, really disrupting that. So you're absolutely right. I think the other thing I'll just say quickly, we've had two decades of really understanding the climate change problem, and we've made virtually no progress at getting on top of it. So that just tells you, just from pure observation, that the present system is failing really, really badly. So that's why we actually said, it's more than technology. It's more than fiddling a bit at the edges. We actually have to really transform ourselves, our societies, and our value systems.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with my guest, Dr. Will Steffen. Will is known internationally in climate circles and beyond, and he's based in Australia, but he also works with the Stockholm Resilience Center. We're talking about a new paper that lays out possible futures for the world climate, and some are livable and others not so much. So, Will, figure 3 in the new paper is titled Global Map of Potential Tipping Cascades. What is a tipping cascade?
Well, this is like the row of dominoes, where one of these individual processes that has a tipping point tips, and it changes the Earth system. It can melt ice and uncover more dark ocean or land, which absorbs more sunlight, heats the planet more, or it can emit CO2 or methane to the atmosphere, or both, which warm the Earth further. And as the Earth warms further, more of these tipping elements then become vulnerable. They start to tip. They increase the temperature further. Some of these elements actually operate by changing ocean circulation, which moves heat through the ocean from hemisphere to hemisphere. So there are a number of connections that once you start tipping some of these elements, they change the Earth system such that they tip other elements. And it's, I think the best analogy is a sort of winding row of dominoes where we start knocking the first couple over and it takes off. So that's what we call a tipping cascade. And this is the fundamental process underneath the fact that the planet as a whole may have a threshold.
This is very interesting to me because, in a way, I've been having an argument with Dr. Guy McPherson about tipping points, and he said that positive feedback loops can work on each other and make each other go stronger, and in a way, that's what your graphic shows.
That's exactly what we're saying. Yep, that's a good way of putting it.
All right, and apparently, we can never go back. Have we already knocked out the cycle of glaciers known for the past few million years?
Yes, I think there's good evidence that we will not go into the next glaciation, so we'll miss that. So will miss a glaciation for about 100,000 years just with what we've already done to the Earth's system. Now, some people may argue that's a good thing, but in fact, that's only the beginning of what's happening if we keep on our present trajectory. And that's what this paper is arguing, is that if we keep on the present trajectory, we're going to go to a much, much hotter state of the Earth's system. So that, of course, would eliminate glaciations for even longer than 100,000 years, probably.
What's our best hope for a stabilized Earth?
That's a good question, and I think people in the humanities and social sciences may have a better answer than I do. All I would say is that we scientists, I think natural scientists, have to do a better job of articulating what the real risks are. And that's what this paper is intended to do. It's intended to be a wake-up call to say we really need to reframe the risks of what we're doing to the planet's climate system and to the Earth system as a whole. I think humanities scholars and social science scholars would have some good ideas about how we actually do start getting a transformation of values, a reorganization of societies, and so on. That's a bit outside of my area of expertise, only to say that I think we have enough evidence to say our present system isn't going to solve this problem, so we have to think and act at a much deeper level to transform our societies.
Well, I'm going to try and go a little deep here, and I can't explain it very well because I'm not a scientist, but I noticed that Dr. Joachim, or John Schellenhuber, is a co-author of your new paper. And in his 2011 speech at the 4 degrees or More conference in Australia, which I broadcast on Radio EcoShock, he said something that always made me wonder. Now, according to my blog notes about that speech, he said studies in physics show the temperature is unlikely to stay anywhere around the 7 degrees C hotter mark. Simple calculations about the wave patterns of matter, he said, suggest the temperature would either rest around 5 degrees or keep migrating up to 10 degrees hotter, where there's another kind of natural plateau. And your paper also talks about possible resting points based on potential energy of the system. It's deep stuff, but can you comment?
Yeah, look, ours roughly corresponds with John's 5 degrees. We're suggesting 4 and 5 degrees. John's a really excellent theoretical physicist on top of everything else he knows about the Earth system. So he's attacking it from one angle. We're looking at, for example, analogs in the past. So you can see that the Earth system has existed for long periods of time, millions of years, in certain states, and then it transitions between these states. And one of these states we see in the recent past, of course, is one that's about 4 or 5 degrees hotter than today, much less ice, quite different climate system. And that, we think, could be accessible if we cross those thresholds or get that cascade going in the next couple of decades.
And there has been a kind of monoculture among some climate scientists and climate activists where it's all about the carbon. But humans have plenty of other impacts, like driving species extinct or cutting down forests or polluting with plastics, and some of those could change the biosphere that supports climate stability. So I was relieved your study went beyond simple carbon counting. Do we need more of that in science?
Absolutely. The paper does focus on the climate system, but again, in the supporting information, you'll see a broader view of the Earth system as a whole. And I think a good way of looking at it is we have the Earth system is made up of two big interacting spheres at the highest level, the geosphere, which people focus on, the physical climate system, but also a biosphere. And in fact, carbon is a beautiful link between the two. We think of carbon only as something that warms the climate if you put too much of it in the atmosphere, but in fact, it's the real currency of the biosphere itself. And we're changing, in addition to burning fossil fuels, of course, we're changing the biosphere directly in a myriad ways. And that, at the moment, is actually more important than the climate impacts on the biosphere. So, yes, it's extremely important that we take a much more holistic, integrated view of the Earth system and of human impacts on the Earth system.
Well, as I said, here in British Columbia and all along the west coast of America, we've just gone through another terror summer of wildfires with massive smoke. And I wonder if the release of all that carbon from trees could affect the climate. Your paper says it's possible, yes?
It certainly is. In fact, one of the tipping elements or tipping processes we talk about are the vast boreal forests of Canada, Alaska, Siberia, Scandinavia. And yes, they can emit a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. So, and we see the best data, in fact, is from Canada, that we see long-term changes that the Canadian forests were basically a sink. They were a net absorber of carbon for much of the 20th century. But around about the 1970s or so, as temperatures started creeping up, we saw, particularly in Western Canada, an increase in spruce bark beetle attacks on the trees, which weakened the trees and made them more prone to disturbances. And, of course, with ever-increasing temperature, fires became more probable. And so you had this double whammy of trees weakened by insect attacks and then fires sweeping through them. And the Canadian Forest Service has done an excellent job of actually tracking the carbon implications of all that. And I found that over the 30 years post 1970, those forests have gone to being carbon neutral at best, and sometimes even net emitters of carbon to the atmosphere. So that's already a big effect on the global carbon cycle.
And what would be the worst trajectory? This hothouse Earth, what would it be like if humans survived to see it?
Okay, if you look at, for example, Australia, much of Australia would be uninhabitable. You simply couldn't live there unless people were trucking in water and you lived in air-conditioned conditions for 24/7. And you can do that around the Earth. Large areas of the tropics and subtropics become uninhabitable. As I said before, the world's big agricultural zones would have to change. Most of them would be damaged beyond repair by a rapidly changing climate. Sea levels would just continuously rise. Extreme weather events would be much, much worse than they are now. And John Schellenhuber himself, I think in that 2011 lecture he gave at Melbourne, said it's not inconceivable that if we go to something like a hothouse Earth, we will have a civilization and population crash. And he suggested down to maybe a maximum carrying capacity of 1 billion humans. We're about 7.5 now. So this is really a collapse scenario. And that's what I think the worst case scenario is, in fact, a collapse scenario, that the contemporary civilization we have today simply cannot exist in a hothouse Earth.
Yes, and we know people have to slash greenhouse gas emissions to keep a livable world, and we've had experts on this show go further, saying we will need to reduce incoming sunlight with geoengineering. But your group adds a third way, namely, quote, enhancing or creating carbon sinks. Well, what can we do there?
Well, obviously, the first thing we can do is protect and restore a lot of the terrestrial sinks that we talked about, Amazon, other tropical forests, some temperate forests, protect the boil. But also there's a huge potential carbon sink in the ocean. The ocean's a big player in the carbon cycle. So protecting coastal zones, they absorb a lot of carbon. There have been proposals that macroalgae, big seaweed, can be enhanced, the growth of that, and that would absorb a lot of carbon. Of course, you've got to get that then down deeper in the ocean to have it there for any length of time. So basically, the way we look at it is about a quarter of the carbon that's up there today that's causing the problem actually originated from the biosphere. So getting that back into the biosphere and protecting it would actually be a big step forward. Of course, that's no substitute for fossil fuel, and that's the problem of a lot of people think, well, we'll just grow trees. No, it's not a substitute at all. All it does is restore some of the earlier emissions from the biosphere.
So if we want to have a habitable world, it sounds like we need to change everything, our consumption, our behavior, our attitudes. I've studied history. I have difficulty recalling such a huge revolution in such a short time frame, maybe at the start of World War II, maybe. Is it really still possible, Will Steffen, to steer Earth without going into that hellish hothouse ditch?
Good question. I think it's a big ask. I think we may have some chance to do it. Humans can move extremely quickly. There are tipping points and radical changes of state in human societies as well, often on the catastrophic side, but occasionally you see societies that reform themselves reasonably quickly. We did after World War II. That's probably the most recent example of where older, more feudal systems around the world were torn down really by this succession of World War I, Great Depression, World War II. And there were quite different economic and governance systems that came out of that. So that was one example, but it took some catastrophic events to trigger that. This time, by the time we get to really catastrophic events, it may be too late if we're right on our hothouse Earth and planetary threshold. So we have to have the foresight to transform ourselves before we actually get into a situation where the Earth system is out of control.
Yes, foresight. That's what we need. So you have advised the Australian government in various ways, and lately Australian politics have gone further off the rails towards more coal development and climate denial. Meanwhile, as you say, farmers in New South Wales are allowed to shoot kangaroos because the drought is so awful. What now for Australia?
Well, I think we're actually, if you look at Australia, Australian society is somewhat in a complex systems view. we're getting much more variability now in the system. Over the past 10 years, we've gone from prime ministers who vigorously supported action on climate change. We put in a meaningful carbon price. That got overthrown. Now we're going through a succession of prime ministers at an increasing rate, mainly because of the climate change issue. That's the underlying thing that's destabilizing politics. But at the subnational level, we have some really positive signs. States like South Australia are already over 50% renewable. Our own little Australian Capital Territory, which is sort of the equivalent of D.C. in the U.S., will be 100% renewable in about 18 months. And we've done that over about 8 or 9 years. So, and that's a city of about 500,000. So you can transform really fast if you put your mind to it. And I think Canberra's crossed a tipping point where now, although there was a lot of angst about how much it would cost to get carbon out of our electricity system, now we want to get carbon out of our entire territory economy by 2045, and it's got widespread support, no problem from the Treasury and economists. So I think we've crossed a tipping point to realize we can actually do this, and it's actually going to benefit us in other ways in addition to the climate benefits. So I'm hoping that things like this, that these social tipping points can come in time to help us get on the right pathway.
It sounds like people and the local governments have just gone ahead well past what the retrograde national government is doing, and that offers some hope for the United States as well.
Indeed. I think that's a good example, too, in the United States. And there's probably a reason for that. I think the big vested interests that want to maintain the fossil fuel world operate at the big levels in governance, operate at the nation-state levels, whereas people who actually understand the risks and feel the impacts already today want to get on with solving it. And the best thing they can do now without getting the national governments moving is to get moving at the local level. And that's happening around Australia, too.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
All I would say is make one more point to your listeners. Often people, when I talk about this paper and other aspects of my work, they say, but you know, give us hope. Can you please give us some hope? And my answer is, actually, you make hope. People themselves make hope. And that's what we've done in Canberra. We've got a much better attitude toward this problem because we're actually going out and doing things and making a difference. So my response to people is, you can do something. And the best thing you can do is get active on this, change your local politics, try to change your national politics. That'll generate hope.
We've been speaking with Dr. Will Steffen, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University and part of the Climate Council of Australia. He's the lead author of a new paper, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. It is available in full text for free, and you can find links to that, plus some quotes and comments, in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Will Steffen, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Did the hot, tumultuous summer of 2018 present a new level of climate change? Who would know if we have left normal behind? Bob Henson is kind of a cross between a meteorologist and a science writer. Among his 5 books is the popular college-level textbook Meteorology Today, written with Donald Ahrens. In his 24 years with the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, and that's a mouthful, and it publishes Atmospheric News, or Atmos News, it's really called, Bob was an editor and writer there. He had the inside track for science. Henson wrote the 2014 guidebook, The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change, and of course he's an admitted storm chaser and blogger at the Weather Underground. When records are set, Bob Henson is keeping track. Bob, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey Alex, great to be back with you again.
So, in last week's Radio EcoShock show, I reported global heat around the Northern Hemisphere this past summer. I said it was beyond normal. And maybe that summer was a unique event not seen before. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it was certainly an exceptional number of all-time record highs set at a number of prominent locations. You know, places like Seoul, South Korea, Glasgow, Scotland, Montreal, some cities in Southern California. So, an unusually wide swath of places that had the hottest temperatures they've ever recorded. So I think it's the breadth of that heat that was really noteworthy. Now, of course, as usual, not every single spot was near records, and there were some cool spots. But I mean, we're going to have to see. The numbers are still several weeks out from knowing what the global average was for the Northern Hemisphere summer, which is, in the meteorological world, it's from June through August. So we don't know yet if it was the warmest summer on record globally or even in the Northern Hemisphere, but certainly one of the warmest. And certainly in terms of these pockets of extremely intense heat, and in some places very persistent, especially in Scandinavia. I think that's what really stands out for me from this summer.
Yeah, Scandinavia, they had massive fires. They had to call in forest fighters from all over the world. 30-degree temperatures up in Lapland. We're talking in the Arctic Circle. They had a very hot summer. I found it very strange.
It absolutely was. I believe it was in Tromsø where they had the first night on record where the temperature stayed in the tropical range, say above 20, I think it was maybe about 26 degrees C. I don't remember precisely, but some climate scientists did a rather ironic photo of themselves sitting outside at dusk holding drinks and, you know, enjoying the first tropical night in that region. Of course, I'm sure it was a bittersweet enjoyment given that this is, you know, emblematic of what's happening to our global climate, but certainly the temperatures were not only extremely hot, but just recurrently and sustainedly hot for most of the summer.
Yeah, some of the people who live there don't even have clothes for that and certainly don't have air conditioners. Now, when it comes to Britain, in the British press, two UK scientists said the summer of 1976 was about as hot as this year, so nothing exceptional. But I have to note that in 1976, there were not heat waves in so many other parts of the world at the same time. It was kind of regional to the UK. What about earlier hot periods, Bob, like the 1930s or 40s? Have we seen anything comparable to this summer?
Well, it depends on what location you're looking at. In Britain, they have a record called the Central England Temperature Record, and what's really exceptional about that is it goes back to the 1600s. It's more than 340 years, so it's by far the longest continuous temperature record in the world, and it's a number of stations located in Central England. So I believe this was in the top three or four hottest summers, certainly up there with 1976, and I believe, I want to say 1824, or somewhere in the 1820s. So that's a pretty rarefied group, you know, the hottest summer in many people's lifetimes in Britain. Now, in the United States, it wasn't the hottest summer for the country as a whole. For some areas, it certainly was. Southern California was, depending on where you were, was one of the very hottest summers we ever recorded. Parts of New England also had one of the very hottest summers on record. In the central part of the U.S., it was closer to average, not exceptionally hot in some parts of the plains. So kind of flanking the two parts of North America, I think, where Western North America and parts of Northeast U.S., Southeast Canada were extremely hot with a little bit of cool, relative mildness in between. So for the continent as a whole, nothing comparable to, say, the heat of 1936 that summer. It's kind of still the standard for record heat, but definitely one that we will be remembering.
It'd be interesting to compare the heat and humidity, if it's possible, to that 1936 event, because it certainly was stinking humid in the east as well. And I have to realize that listeners from the middle of America and onward east, they're not worried about wildfires or drought. They're bailing out basements after floods and extreme rainfall events. And, Bob, I thought flood season was in the spring, but now, is it any time?
Pretty much, yeah. And I think this is an underappreciated fact that many of the impacts related to climate change are going to be more related to water and the lack of it or having too much of it rather than temperature. You know, we can adapt in some ways as temperature creeps upward. There are many, many impacts, but also there are adaptation mechanisms, at least for humans. But when it comes to water, it's just very difficult to cope with either end of the water extreme. If you're simply not getting rain, you can't grow crops. There's many, many complications. Getting too much rain, there's only so much you can do to keep the floods at bay. So we have had a lot of localized flooding, certainly the Mid-Atlantic. I think Baltimore had one of the wettest months in its history, I believe, either July or August was. And now in September, the Midwest is getting hammered with a recurrent, repeated serious flooding. It's either too much or too little water, it seems. And I think the summer has been a good illustration of that.
Yeah, and Tropical Storm Gordon just struck Florida and the Gulf Coast last week, and it moved very slowly. It was dumping lots of rain. We've seen similar slow-motion storms, well, like Hurricane Harvey over Texas and others. Is that new, and what does it mean?
Well, it's not new to have storms move slowly. However, there is a trend apparent, and a couple of researchers have recently looked closely at this. There is a trend toward more slow-moving storms, and we'll have to see how that manifests. Now, you have so much variability with hurricanes that it can be difficult to get the trend outside of the noise. So when we talk about a trend, you know, we're talking about a, you know, maybe a mile or two an hour difference in forward motion, but any one hurricane could be moving at 30 miles an hour or 2 miles an hour. So, but nevertheless, there is this detectable trend toward slower moving storms, and that's a real concern because it's expected to increase, and the likelihood of getting slow-moving hurricanes is expected to continue to go up. So that was certainly the hallmark of Hurricane Harvey last year. It dumped large amounts of rain where it was raining, but it was simply the fact that it moved slowly that really made the difference and made it such a catastrophe.
We have the rare appearance of a typhoon in Hawaii with 4 feet of rain. That's noteworthy. But for me, the chain of typhoons striking Japan, including the last violent storm, seems exceptional, but maybe it's not. What do the records say about what's happening with Japan?
Well, Japan has had years with bad typhoons. They actually get, on average, 2 to 3 named storms a year. So they are there in the bowling alley, if you will. Now, most of those are typically either tropical storm strains or maybe Category 1 typhoons by the time they get to Japan. Now, the one that just struck, named Jebi, was actually a Category 2. So according to the Japan Meteorological Agency, it was the strongest landfall they've had in 25 years. And one illustration of its power, the airport at Kansai, which is near the port of Osaka, they actually fortified that airport with flood protection that was intended to keep any typhoons at bay and also be prepare them for rising sea levels. Well, that airport, about half of it flooded the other day as this typhoon came in. And the bridge that connects, the only land connection from that airport to the rest of the country, was damaged. So about 5,000 people were stuck at the airport for a few hours. So I think that's a great example of the infrastructure challenges we face in a climate that's evolving. We think we've built, you know, and prepared ourselves for a certain event, and lo and behold, we get this storm surge, which in the case of the bay at the port of Osaka was the highest surge they've ever measured.
Wow. And then we have a report that a large city in Algeria recorded 51.3 degrees C or 123.4 degrees Fahrenheit in July. And if that's confirmed, that would be the highest reliable temperature ever recorded in Africa. And that's saying something. Have you heard anything more on that?
No, I haven't. I haven't been following that one closely. Certainly Death Valley was a record setter this year. They had the hottest single month in July, not only for the United States, but for the world as a whole. If you look at the average temperature, averaging both the highs and the lows for the whole month.
The highest average temperature for the whole world was set this summer.
Yep. If you take an entire month and you essentially take the highs and the lows and munge them together, and find out what is the single average for that whole month, 24/7 average. I believe it was 107 or 108 Fahrenheit. Mind you, that's including highs and lows.
Wow.
So a pretty extreme climate, to say the least. And that just nudged them above the previous record, which was also set in Death Valley. So that's very significant locally, but also, you know, very evocative globally of a warming climate.
Kind of a flag, yes. And when nights don't cool down, I know that's very dangerous for human health. And NPR reported that on June 26th in Kiryat Oman, the low temperature of nearly 109 degrees Fahrenheit was the highest ever recorded in the world. I don't know. It seems like nighttime lows might be as important to watch as the daytime highs.
Certainly, in terms of heat wave impacts, nighttime lows are hugely important. You know, it can be pretty easy to get through one hot day if you have access to shade and so forth, even if you don't have air conditioning at home. But at night, your body is counting on that break from the heat. And if the temperature is run really high for multiple nights, then an unair-conditioned house just won't have a chance to cool down, and the interior temperatures can get very high, and it's just much harder for a body to take multiple days like that. So certainly the added moisture in the atmosphere is one factor. Interestingly, in places that grow a lot of corn, such as Iowa and Illinois, there's been a very marked trend in the last couple of decades as this corn growing has intensified and there's more corn per acre, that corn puts out a lot of moisture from the ground. So what ends up happening is the summer days are actually getting slightly cooler, but the summer nights are getting quite a bit warmer. So you have a constricted temperature range, but a little higher than the temperature range was before. So you may not have the scorching summer days in that neck of the woods, but the nights are getting more and more insufferable.
What other weather events or records are on your mind or in your Weather Underground blog?
Well, it's hurricane season, so obviously we're dealing with that. It was looking like a fairly quiet Atlantic season, but things have certainly gotten busy here in the first part of September. So that looks like that may continue for a few more days. I'm going to be watching to see what happens with El Nino. There is considered to be a pretty good chance we're going to have El Nino this winter, but it's not for sure yet. It hasn't quite come together as quickly as we thought it might. But if we do get a move toward El Nino, I think that will push us potentially toward another global record high. You know, we set global records in 2014, 15, and 16, and 2017 was right behind those three. So when we have an El Nino going on, that's actually spreading warm water across the tropical Pacific, and that warmth percolates from the atmosphere to the air. So when we have global records these days, it's almost always during an El Nino because the warming climate kind of expresses itself in those records during El Nino. So if we do get an El Nino, I would predict that we have a good chance of yet another global record in 2018, if not 2017.
I wonder, Bob, what it would take to say we're in the Anthropocene weather period.
Oh, boy, that's a good question. Yeah, nobody really knows. It's difficult to pin down what the flavor of the Anthropocene will be like, in part because it's a moving target, you know, or when you have, you know, the greenhouse gas forcing that is leading to climate change getting more and more intense over time, it takes time for that push toward a warmer climate to kind of filter through the whole system, through the oceans and so forth. So we actually have warming that's tucked away in the oceans that has yet to be expressed in the atmosphere. In other words, even if we turned off every engine and didn't burn a drop of fossil fuel, we still have maybe another degree Fahrenheit of atmospheric warming on the way. So because of all that, you know, I don't think we're going to get to a new normal. And I've heard several people actually saying new normal is not really the optimal phrase anymore. It's sort of like a new shifting norm that we won't be able to count on because it's going to be continually moving in that warmer direction and towards more hydrologic extremes. Now most weather will still look familiar. You know, most days will still be like days we've experienced in the past, but the extremes will be getting a little more extreme in many places at many times.
Well, talking about how that's all going to develop, there are groups of scientists who worry about abrupt climate change, something unmanageable, developing over just a few decades or even less. And I know in the U.S., the National Research Council had a committee on abrupt climate change, and the Pentagon has considered the implications of a shift, but that's a remote possibility for them. What do you think?
Well, you know, to be honest, I feel like I have my hands full, certainly, thinking about the more confident changes, you know, the already definite trend toward extreme rainfall getting more extreme, general global temperatures rising, central freeways get worse. All those things kind of are not reliant on an abrupt change. Those are simply kind of baked into the way climate change is going to work as the climate warms. So I personally tend to focus more on those, if only because they're a little more confident. When you get to lower probability events, those can be, of course, much higher impact, but there's a lot more uncertainty around them. So I think certainly in terms of public planning, it becomes a harder sell. I mean, just to give you an example, when you have a hurricane watch issued by the U.S. National Weather Service or the cone of uncertainty around a hurricane, that's not actually the outer bounds. It's more like the two-thirds probability range. So whenever you see that watch or that cone, there's a 1 in 3 chance the hurricane will go outside of it. So we don't really plan for those 1 in 3 chances because you can't always be planning for the very low probability things. So I sort of think of it in terms of a spectrum. Like we put most of our energy in preparing for the impacts we know are most confident from climate change while keeping an eye on the outer ones like abrupt climate change. And I'm certainly not at all discounting the possibility of abrupt climate change. I think it's a really serious concern. But I do think there's also non-abrupt ones that are maybe even a little less sexy but more certain. You know, nuisance flooding is a great example of that. You know, the floods that are now striking places like South Florida every single autumn with the king tides, those are just going to continue to get worse and worse. And there was a major study out on that this year. Places that now get a flood like that maybe 3 or 4 times a year could get them 180 times a year within our lifetimes, you know, in the next several decades. So that's something that's not reliant on an abrupt climate change. That's simply a prediction.
Especially with the rising seas. I mean, if something happens 180 days a year, it's time to realize your place is going under and time to move.
Yeah, and we're going to have, I think, an economic, you know, reverberation that will be striking and profound along coastlines, especially low-lying coastlines, say, in the southeast U.S., because sooner or later it's going to catch up with people that certain places near the coast are just not going to be livable. And the question is, who will get out first? And once people start selling properties, you can get a chain reaction. So I think some neighborhoods are people are really going to get hurt and not be able to predict exactly the timing of those shifts. So I think that's a real economic challenge, not only for those localities, but for states and regions as well.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with meteorologist and science journalist Bob Henson. You can join his 5,000 Twitter followers at bhensonweather.com. Today we're talking about extreme weather and climate change in the summer of 2018. It's been wildly hot in the Arctic, as you know, Bob. Glaciers are losing billions of tons of water mass, and the summer sea ice is low again. It's not necessarily a record, but it's low, and it's very thin. There's hardly any old ice. Do you think that the extreme changes in the Arctic already contribute to disturbed weather further south?
I have a strong sense that they are. It's a really interesting area of research, and I think work on that has been led by Jennifer Francis at Rutgers, and Judah Cohen at Atmospheric Environment Research. And your listeners have probably heard their names, Cohen and Francis. They've done quite a few papers on the connection between changes in the Arctic and changes in mid-latitude weather. And some of those have been a little counterintuitive, a tendency toward perhaps more intense winter storms in the northeast when sea ice is low. And those kind of connections that aren't necessarily expected that may be there, I think, are really important to study. Anyway, that work continues, and I think it's slowly gaining more widespread attention. It has been considered sort of a niche area for a few years, but I think more people are starting to pay attention to it now. And certainly as the Arctic continues to melt and we have longer and longer periods of more and more open water, I don't see how it can't affect the region at least. And its effects on the jet stream are more subtle, but really interesting. For example, summertime weather patterns slowing down and getting stuck. There was an important paper led by Michael Mann of Penn State on that just in the past year or so. So, yeah, I do think that the Arctic sea ice loss is important with respect to mid-latitude climate. I think it's still early days in terms of research in that area, but I think we will learn a lot about it in the next few years.
And, of course, I'm impressed by the wildfires because one came so close to my house this summer and I was in the smoke for so long, but looking at a global wildfire map, they were all across the Northern Hemisphere. It was just amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And I started to wonder, well, maybe these wildfires could release enough carbon and aerosol particles to actually change the climate, whether it's in the short term or the long term. Have you been seeing anything on that in the science writing that you look at?
I cannot say that I have. Certainly there are huge volumes of aerosols put out by fires. And, you know, I don't know where those stand in terms of magnitude with respect to all the other forcing factors. We do know that there were massive wildfires in North America in the late 1800s as, you know, folks were moving into these forested areas and establishing settlements and basically just tearing down the forests. And these massive fires would sweep across the region and even into the early 1900s. So it would be interesting, if possible, to go back and look at those and see how those affected local and regional and even hemispheric climate. But certainly the fires of today are catastrophic because they're affecting places where, in many places where people have moved in the last several decades. You know, there's been a move toward what we call the urban wildland interface, where people want to live near a city but also be in beautiful forested country. Well, unfortunately, wildfires head right to those areas, just like any other part of the forest. So I think the impacts on people have really grown intense, and certainly the intensity of the burning of the fires has been an issue in many places because of the more intense drying of some of the forests and the nearby landscape. You can get a couple degrees of cooling if you're in the ash cloud or really thick smoke from a fire. And they actually kept some places from setting record highs this summer that otherwise might have.
Interesting, interesting. Might throw the records off. I was in a very cold day one day in kind of a fire smog. I want to move on to how the media treats this extreme weather we've seen and climate change. A recent report by the nonprofit group Public Citizen found that during the recent heat wave, in 90% of the articles about that heat wave, the largest 50 U.S. newspapers did not mention climate change at all. Another group, Media Matters, looked at coverage by the American major TV networks. And in that critical two-week period from late June to early July, they found only one segment out of 127 about the heat, only one mentioned climate change at all. So that real story is it's missing in action, don't you think?
I do think it is often missing in action. It can be difficult to always bring in climate change in a sort of stereotyped way, and I would hate to see it just become a rote sentence that is the same in every single article, because then I think readers would tend to gloss over. There is, you know, some social science research has shown that if you repeat a message over and over, it actually does tend to sink in. But personally, I try to vary the message, you know, vary the tempo. I think sometimes it's nice to bring in readers who may just turn the page the moment they see the words climate change. So I like to engage some of those readers and then get them used to the blog. And then when they see a climate change article, maybe they'll trust me enough to pay attention, I hope. So, yeah, I think it is an issue. And think about, for example, reports on health conditions and how often those are tied back to causes. And they aren't always. And maybe those should be as well. Maybe every story on lung cancer should mention that smoking is the primary cause. And I think a lot of times they do. And I think we might notice if there are many stories on lung cancer and not a single one mentioned smoking, we would be like, wait a minute, that ought to be in here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, along the same lines, a new poll in Britain shows that after the heat wave, 72% of British adults are very or fairly concerned about climate change. The numbers always go up after heat waves or superstorms. People, it seems, have to experience it for themselves. But, Bob, can we really wait until we fry to change away from fossil fuels?
Well, this is makes me think of if you have a wildfire beating down on you, or let's say you're being told that there could be a wildfire in the next 2 days or a hurricane in a week, don't you think it's human tendency to wait till the last minute? You know, we always want to wait until we know we have to do something. And so I think that's the rub. And I agree with you. I don't think it's wise to wait until the last minute. We really should be addressing climate change sooner rather than later. And as you know, that's got to involve both adapting and mitigating. In other words, dealing with the changes that we already have and that are coming that we're sure of, and trying to keep those future changes to a minimum, which is the mitigation piece of it. And for so long, there was a battle between those two, and people said we can only do one or the other. And, of course, I really think we have to do both and ramp up those efforts as well.
Your job and my radio show will have lots to do, probably more than we can even report. How do you feel about that, and do you think weather watchers will be able to cope?
It's a struggle at times, to be honest. I had periods where I felt quite discouraged, and I'm keenly interested in both weather and climate. I always have been, and it's a passion of mine to write about them and a joy. But the topic can be a downer. There's no getting around that. And I especially hate to see us stepping backward, and I hate to see policies where we allow more emissions rather than less, and especially if those are kind of penny-wise and pound foolish. So moving in that direction have discouraged me some in the last year or two. So I'm hoping that we turn the tide on those, and we just got to reduce fossil fuel emissions. That's the root cause of climate change, and there are many ways to do that and many strategies, and we have to keep our eyes on that prize. And I should say also that in particular, coal emissions have an incredible side benefit. By reducing those coal emissions, there are huge benefits to public health. And because coal emissions have such profound impact on respiratory systems and so forth, I think by reducing fossil fuels, we'll have major health benefits. And that should be additional motivation, as if we needed any more motivation.
Yeah, we can live longer. That's a bonus. Now, something that you just mentioned earlier, which is people getting too overdriven about a particular subject, getting worn out about it. And we could have so many climate-driven disasters, so many bad weather incidents, that we just take it for granted as another part of life, as the new normal. What if we get bored watching weather porn on TV and just tune it out?
Oh, that can happen. I think I know folks that are already there, and I feel that way sometimes myself. I think we just have to stay sensitized. And I think a sense of proportion is helpful. You know, there's hurricanes every year. There are tornadoes every year. In a sense, it's normal to have a few records here and there. What would be strange is if every single day of every month the temperature hit the average high and the average low. I actually did a micro study for my textbook, and I took 1 month to see how often in that month the high and the low were exactly on average. And I think it was maybe one day in that month. So it's normal to have variations in weather and climate. What's not normal is to have the variations relentlessly going toward a hotter climate and relentlessly going toward extreme rains and snows getting more extreme. So those are the signals that, mixed in with all this natural variability, we have climate change. So when we cover like specific weather and climate events, I think it's important to link those to climate change where appropriate. And the stronger the link, the more to emphasize it. But if we hit every single event with the same hammer, then I think people will kind of get numb to it. So I think it is important to be proportionate.
And the other thing is that I remember growing up as a kid, summer was the good weather. That was the time to look forward to. We had maybe thunderstorms, but I didn't worry about wildfires. I never heard about wildfires, and I lived in Canada. And the kind of heat waves, if it got hot for a couple of days in August, that was a big deal. But now it's like constant. It starts in early June in Toronto, Canada, and runs right up into September, where people are just sweating their way through the summer. It's not the good times we used to look forward to.
Yeah, but I have to say it's, for one thing, the margins of seasons. It's not just that it gets hotter in the middle of, say, summer, but that the edges of a certain level of heat are pushing in either direction. So the heat starts sooner and ends later in the year. So that taps into things like school years kicking in say, August or September, when it's still really hot. You might have to go get air conditioners for an entire school system where it wasn't once necessary. And the middle of the summer, which was once pleasant, is now more often intolerable, depending on your level of heat tolerance. So, and those are real-life feelings. And I think in particular, I think about the Western U.S. and Western Canada. You know, when I started dealing with climate change quite a bit after I joined NCAR in 1989, at that point, the climate models were pretty crude. And the message was generally continents will get hotter faster than oceans. So when you look at a very crude map of North America, there would be a little hot blob right in the middle of the continent. Well, now we know and we're seeing that the heat is manifesting a little bit more towards, say, western U.S., western Canada, and then also toward northeast U.S. and parts of eastern Canada. And it's not heating up quite as much as we thought it would, say, in the Midwest and Great Plains. And to me, that's fascinating. I think it's partly because the models 30 years ago just weren't precise enough to show us that. But also effects like I talked about agriculture, which has become extremely intense in the Midwest, is a different form of human altering of the ecosystem. So you've got kind of climate change trying to warm the climate in that region through fossil fuels, but increased agriculture kind of blunting the temperature range. And kind of what is a real climate or what is natural weather anymore? We really don't know. It's kind of like the metaphor of the garden. That's once it's tended, it's never going to be a wild place again, and we just have to deal with that.
I totally agree with you. We've kind of cycled back to where we began, that we don't know what normal is for sure. We're going to have to leave it there, Bob. We've been talking with meteorologist, journalist, and storm guy Bob Henson, and I think of his blogs at the Weather Underground, but Bob publishes all over the place and in mainstream publications. His textbook teaches college kids, and his insight teaches all of us. You can follow B. Henson Weather on Twitter and check out Bob's blog at www.wonderground.com. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, well, thank you, Alex. My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. My thanks to supporters and everyone who dares to tune into these unpleasant truths. Don't forget to follow up with links and more on my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. May we all see less worse days ahead.